They're going to start charging us for.
They decided to reallocate resources in a different way than we wanted.
Does it shoot lasers out? Because it's kind of crooked. Say, like you're in a lot of fire.
Can we have an explanation of the risk factor of this new machine? There is an opening that's aimed at me.
Yeah. And one of the engines.
Oh, yeah.
Is this purchased a Radio Shack before they went bankrupt for the second time?
Is that the fate of Radio Shack?
Yeah, the second time in 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
They refiled.
Poor people. Well, Amazon's probably taken the lunch. So.
Yeah.
Alrighty, so we shall begin 12:04.
Well, good day, everyone. We're glad to be back at the table in collective bargaining negotiations. I said that without a bit of sarcasm.
But with a smile.
With a smile.
You have some new people on your team, don't you?
There's new people all around. So I think maybe what we should do is introduce ourselves.
Okay.
Is that okay, John?
Sure.
All right. Ross, start with you.
I was going to make a comment about starting with me, but I won't. Ross Wolf, Associate Dean in the College of Health and Public Affairs.
Lynn Hefner, Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Humanities.
Lucretia Cooney, Faculty Excellence.
I'm Michael Matamore with Alan Norton and Blue.
Sherry Andrews, Associate General Counsel.
I'm Charlie Piper, and I'm with Contract Compliance and Administrative Support.
Ashley Connors, Contract Compliance and Administrative Support. Jim Cronowitz, Academic Affairs. Helen Sterlock, Academic Affairs. Sarah Lovell, HR. You.
Dan Murphy, UFF Grievance Committee Chair, Observer. Patrick Sacleux, Modern Languages and Literature.
Alexis George, I'm an UCF Journalism Student. Beatrice Reyes Foster, Anthropology.
John Rabel, Center for Distributed Learning.
Lorenzo, Central
Mason Cash from Philosophy.
Nick Shrubsel, Philosophy.
John Faust, Biology.
Carrie Watson, Art History.
Barry Maurer, English.
And Lee Ross, Criminal Justice.
Okay, so is Patty no longer on the team?
Right, Patty didn't have time to do it this semester.
One session was all she could handle. I get it.
Oh, and she's had a bunch of operations on her knee, too, so she's been hobbled the last... Actually, last semester she was as well. She gutted it out pretty tough. She had to get a knee scoped.
I'm afraid that's going to be in my future, not too distant future.
A replacement or a...
I don't know.
So we all introduced ourselves just now? And everyone sang a song. So, if you could pick something short.
So you want a short meeting.
Chuck Ryan.
Good afternoon, I'm Chuck Ryan. And I will not sing. How's it going, Chuck?
Well,
looks like you've got a stack of papers there.
Yeah, do we have minutes to approve from last time? Do we need to do that?
We'll just start.
Start from
fresh.
Scratch? Okay. So it's our turn?
Sure, John.
Boy, it's throwing us off. Usually we have minutes to approve, and Mike starts us, and our rhythm's going to be off from the very beginning.
Oh, that's right. We don't. We should say. But do we have to do an opening for this? For our little machine?
Well, I thought about it, and then I figured, I was leaving it up to you. Do you want to give the date and such?
Okay, if I remember it. It's March 20th. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yeah. We're off to a good start. 2017, collective bargaining negotiations between the University of Central Florida Board of Trustees and the University of Central Florida Chapter of the United Faculty of Florida.
And Tracy Clark is going to be here in a few minutes, but go ahead and do your stuff.
I thought we'd start with something kind of fun and informative. Make sure I pick one. So there's that one.
Thank you.
Oh, you did? Thank you. We just know that the scribble is Nick.
I think we might have it after all this stuff. So folks who've been doing bargaining for a while might recall seeing this in September of 2014. So we just completed another bargaining poll for UFF. And
can I ask how many people you surveyed?
332.
350. Well, 350 total, exactly.
350 people. Mm-hmm. So that's not just your... Okay.
No, this is the whole bargaining unit.
Whole bargaining unit is 1,500 people.
Yeah, so we got, in a week, we got 350 responses
okay.
back.
So that's why I wanted to know, was it just in-unit, your in-unit members?
Yeah, so it's our bargaining unit. And so this is a question that we'd asked before. The first question is whether UCF offers the best, is continuing to offer the best undergraduate education available in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is about international prominence. The third is the international focus. The fourth is becoming more inclusive and diverse, and the fifth is being America's leading partnership university. And the higher scores, the strongly agree, are the top bar in each one of those plots. And what you can see from this is that in all five of the categories, we're at least in the middle and leaning towards the upper end of strongly agreeing or agreeing. With one really strong exception, which is becoming more inclusive and diverse. In that case, it's really strong up towards the agree to strongly agree portion. And I think that reflects, you know, what's been happening on campus in the last 4 to 5 years.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that was pretty nice to see. And especially if you look at kind of the trailing end, the dissenters, there are only 9 folks who strongly disagreed with that sentiment that we'd become more inclusive and diverse. So only 9 people thought, no, it's gone the opposite way. So that was just...
That's encouraging.
Yeah, actually. That was encouraging. So that was kind of fun. Good
so
thing
just
to
be clear, it went to everyone. It went to 1,500 and 332
right.
responded.
Right.
Yeah,
just
within a span of about...
it's still open.
No, we closed it.
It's closed.
We closed at midnight. So that was in the span of about 7, 8, 9 days over spring break. So that was a lot of responses. It was actually more than we got in September of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember right, we had
it's
like 293.
Yeah.
So 350 is, no, that's a good response rate.
Yeah, I mean, typically you get very low response rates. So these
yeah, usually you have to beg. The last time I think we opened it for 2 weeks or maybe a little bit more. And it was during the semester and everything else. So that was encouraging. Okay, so we've got an Article 3 for you. Everybody has them. Article 3 is pretty much a status quo with one line added that's highlighted in yellow, and the rest is mostly just kind of cleaning up the language. And so the line in yellow actually just reflects what's been...
Come on in.
Tracy.
What's been common practice for quite a while, I think. I'm not sure how long. And so it's just adding the line that UCF UCF. UFF shall have the right to use an office on the UCF main campus, and we already have an office, and that's just formalizing that. And aside from that, I believe that everything else is just a matter of changing will to shall and other, you know, just cleaning up the language. At least that's the intent of it.
Okay. Not a lot to discuss there. I don't think we need to break into the caucus.
No questions. Just give your folks time to look at it.
When you say preceding academic year, you're basically on 3.3A. You're basically saying the same thing, you're just crossing out the prior to the beginning of the academic year. So you're saying
yes.
Of the preceding academic year. I'm not sure that that is clearer, but I mean, as long as we both understand what it means.
Yeah, the intent is not to, the language isn't designed to change the intent. The intent's supposed to be the same.
So
it's just trying to shorten it.
The only time that this becomes a little problematic is getting the list of UFF members for summer. Because May 1st is very, very late for us to get that information. So I was considering, since you've opened that up, I was considering asking if there could be maybe a different bright line for summer, maybe around March 1, because we need to get summer contracts out to people, and your chairs are complaining because they don't know who's in and who's out, and we don't have a way to have that happen until May 1st.
Yeah, the problem we have is that our elections
are in April,
and so we're kind of constrained by having to have the elections first and before we can make those decisions. That's, I know I've heard those same comments,
you know,
from chairs, and we try to.
Is there a way we can split the difference or something? I don't know when your elections are. August, April 1st, or no? That's that doesn't sound right.
April.
I'll check the date.
I wanted to say 25th,
but they can become effective in September, right? So you've got to. It's just that I hear a lot from the chairs, they complain because, and your people that are currently in office stay in office until September 1st. So I think it's possible that if you could give me just summer, we might be able to help the departments clarify who's going to be working for the UFF over the summer.
The elections are April 14th if needed.
So it's something to contemplate. It's not, I mean, obviously we've lived with it all these years, but it's just been an uncomfortable fit. I don't mind May 1st for fall and spring of the following year, especially since in November you have a chance to do a course correction on spring, before November 1st, rather. But if you want to talk amongst yourselves, and it's no rush on that, obviously. And again, I'm not sure that the preceding academic year is clear, because that implies that you're starting with fall, because summer's not a semester. So I don't know.
We need to fix that.
I don't want to make it clear. Whatever it is, I don't care particularly. But that's what I mean when I need summer first, if you don't mind.
No, anything we can do to make things operational and functional, we should do. Okay, so we need to.
Can I just clarify what you were asking there? It sounded to me like the election results started in this September, and in May we will tell you about September, about the year and then the following summer.
I could be wrong, but my understanding
so
was that the UFF elections take place in April, but the officers don't take office until September 1st, is what I had always understood. Now, if that's changed, I wouldn't know. But that means that any officers that were in place before the April elections would still be in place until September in the fall. So that means any course releases that you had would already be planned. But the chairs and stuff are pushing back because they don't know who is going to be released or not. And so for some members, it's awkward. Does that clarify for you?
Yeah, we usually, our officers take office at the beginning of the fall semester, right?
Right.
So
there'd
August.
Be new people set up here in September, would it? We'd always be telling you maybe about the following summer, not the one just starting right now.
Well, let's just say in April you get an entirely new board of UFF members, an entirely new collective bargaining negotiator. Those people don't take office until September. So anyone that you were planning to give a course release to for summer, you would already know who they would be.
Right.
Before
that's
your
right.
elections.
And told
yeah.
you
no, that's right.
No, you tell me.
Like now.
Now.
Right.
I have to know before, according to this document, the latest you can give me the summer listing of release time is May 1st. That's so, so close. You're right on top of it. And it's very awkward for people who have to make agreements, for the chairs who don't know whether or not someone's going to be available to teach. So.
Because summer contracts start the 8th, I mean?
7th, 8th, yeah. It'll summer start the day after. The a lot of it. Summer A does.
Summer
C does. Summer D does.
Right. Just not summer D.
Right. So. May 1st is really late to learn about May 8th.
Yeah, I'm sorry to understand this stuff. I thought, given that we haven't, if we like the scenario you were just suggesting, John, we have an entire new set of people. Anyone who's getting summer release would be the previous year's people that we told you about last May.
But you haven't told them about them yet.
We tell you about.
Yes.
May we tell you about right now, summer, and.
Yes.
You know,
I'm happy if you want to tell me now. For now and next summer, I'll take it. But that's not how it's been working.
Right. So if you had your druthers, what date would you pick? Like, what would be the latest date you'd think is...
We start working on summer contracts in February, March. Right, guys? By mid-February, you're starting the information. And we get worksheets for summer.
We have our summer already.
Worksheets go out the end of February. We get them back 2 weeks later.
So mid-February is when our processes are running and when we need to let people know. Okay.
Okay, so
in a worst case scenario, does that mean that you won't honor late submissions? Let's say we have an emergency, I don't know.
We're not able to offer release time after the dates that are indicated in the contract.
I'm sorry, I'm taking notes here. So you said
that's okay.
Mid-February or early February?
Mid-February,
mid-February
would be lovely. It sure is a heck of an improvement on May 1st.
Okay, we'll have to talk about this, of course.
Of course. And you may need a different date for summer than the rest of the year. That's okay, too.
Do you mind, since we have so many of our people here, if we just run a quick caucus?
Well, we could, except we have Tracy here to give a presentation, and I want to release her. Then you can talk about it after, if you like. Is that okay?
Well, because we have a whole salary proposal coming next.
Right.
We can defer it to Tracy if you want.
I'd rather... We've got things ready to go.
Okay.
This is contract stuff. Yeah. Let's get it going.
All right, why don't you let us have what you have on the table,
yeah,
and then we'll go to Tracy. But we don't need to have this. This discussion doesn't have to be resolved now.
No,
right.
Let's go on to wages, and then we'll go to Tracy.
Well, let's take a caucus, because we've got this on our mind. We've got most of our folks here, and so,
right.
I mean, just like 10 minutes.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure.
So back at like 12:30, is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. Get that clock so
late. Yeah. Ross
should be right. You should be right.
Ross just verified the clock's right.
Hey, Ashley.
Oh.
Okay. It looks like this one's recording.
Okay. I was saying that we made a lot of progress in that 10 minutes, so that was really useful for us.
Good. Thank you, John.
Okay, so we're on to Article 23 that we've got for you. Put this in.
Sorry, Barry.
Don't worry. Okay, before we get to that, we wanted to share some more information from our survey.
There's another one.
And so here's some data from the poll that we concluded late last night. One of the issues that we knew was a problem for members of our bargaining unit were salary inequities. And that came through really loud and clear in the survey, where we allowed folks to identify what should be the priorities in terms of salaries. Almost half identified correcting existing inequities as a priority. And so this is a bucket list where they can just check out as many as they want. There's no restriction there. When we said, just pick one, so what's the top, what should be the top priority, then 26% identified correcting existing salary inequities as the top priority. So that was number two, right behind keeping up with the cost of living. And so those were quite high numbers, and especially given that we may, hopefully next time in full book, go to a three-year contract. I'm not seeing any nodding of the head, so maybe we won't be doing that. But at least that's a potential. This would be a good time to hopefully address some of those inequities. And
when you're talking about inequities, you're talking about the issues of compression?
Compression, inversion, market equity,
yeah,
those sorts of things. And then the poll also asked about how the respondents felt about being rewarded for loyalty, effort, and accomplishments. And so the first figure there is the loyalty question, and that's the exact statement: faculty loyalty to UCF is rewarded, and then folks can strongly disagree and so on. And the average is in the disagree to moderate category, to the no opinion category. But if you look at the strongly disagree and disagree, you've got 201 responses there versus to the other side, only 42. So it's almost a 5-to-1 ratio there. When the statement is worded as whether faculty members are rewarded fairly for the amount of effort they put in, you get virtually the same results. And then if you flip to the other side, when the statement is whether faculty members are rewarded fairly considering their accomplishments, you get a similar result, not quite as strong as the others, but still with 178 strongly disagreeing versus only 70 that agree or strongly agree. So you've got a 2.5-to-1 ratio. And then those last two bolded items, the poll asked whether folks reported sought other employment in this current academic year, and 22% said they had. When we asked if they planned to seek it in the next year, it was 23%. And so there's this consistent 20%, 1 in 5 folks who are saying that they're looking for a job other than UCF, and that's concerning. And you know, we do have a high turnover rate here. So there are different ways to help retain and reward faculty, and so we've got some suggestions on those in our Article 23. And before we go to those, I wanted to share this information with you as well.
Do you have a couple others?
They're coming around. Yeah, next time we have to make a few more. I need 20.
No, I don't have one. I'll just look on.
Does this have a title?
Promotion increase.
Promotion increase, yeah. That's what's called promotion increase.
Document 3.4.
Well, it's document 4, but...
All right, so this table compiles what the current promotion increases are for the different universities, and they're ranked from the highest percentage promotion to the lowest amount. And one column is for increases to associate professor or their equivalent, and the other one's to full professor or the equivalent. And you can see where UCF is. We're down towards the bottom of the pile, so we're lagging behind again. And especially with all the new hires we've had in the last 3 to 4 years, pretty soon those folks are going to be coming up for tenure and promotion. And in a lot of cases, their salaries are already lower than comparable universities. And so increasing the promotion steps would help get them back up to parity with at least the other universities in Florida. And it's one of those incremental steps where it's not a lot of people in one set year. And so it doesn't require a big investment this year or next year, but it's incremental over time, and that would build up and help get us back to where we should be, especially given the faculty's ability to get performance funding and things like that, despite the ever-shifting targets set by the legislature.
Yeah.
That was as polite as I could phrase it. Any questions?
No, I don't think so, John. We're good.
You're good? Okay.
I think what we'd like to do, John, is take this and read it carefully, and then come back and ask questions. Go ahead.
Well, let us explain our rationale, our thinking, and then make sure that we address any questions that come up as we go through.
Okay.
So the changes in 23.2
mm-hmm.
Reflect exactly, you know, what's in the promotion increase table. So it would be increasing promotion for the ranks of assistant to associate up to 12%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the language from 23.2A is just repeated for 23.2B, except for the increase would be up to 15%.
Okay.
So that's the change there.
Anything that's legislatively mandated will be done in accordance with the legislature.
Right, so 23.3, mm-hmm. that's kind of been our standard terminology for that.
Right.
And I don't know if you've heard anything in Tallahassee, but...
You know, no, not really. There's a salary increase for state employees in the governor's budget, so I don't know if they're going to mirror that in the state university system or not.
No, there is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what they have?
It's
the governor had it in his budget? Or in
governor the has a raise for state employees in his budget. I don't know if that's going to get, if it's adopted, will it be carried over to the state university or not? I don't know.
Yeah. Do you know what the amount is or the percentage?
Yeah, it's it really comes down to like $1,000 non-recurring, and then $500 like merit.
Okay, so it's a little different than, because I think we've only had one state mandated increase since Governor Scott.
One was a flat fee like that.
Yeah, one, I think it was $1,000.
The last one was the same way. Mm-hmm. $1,000 and then some strange merit formula.
Yeah, it did have a really unusual merit formula. Mm-hmm. But I think it was recurring, right? It was to the base salary.
Yeah, this isn't to the base. This is
recurring. This is essentially a bonus or a one time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I'm reading down, there's an across the board increase in your proposal of 2.7%. Am I reading that right?
Yes, that's correct. And so that's the most current inflation rate estimate for year over year.
Okay.
The next estimate comes out on April 14th. So that's been ticking upward throughout the year. At the beginning of the year, if I remember right, it was 1.7 or 1.8. So it's jumped up a whole percent in the last few months.
Consumer price index?
Yes.
Okay.
The changes to the dates that you see are intended to just reflect the next year. Okay. Hopefully there aren't any errors in that one. We struck out the one-time payment because that was in lieu of retroactive from last time.
Right.
In the merit salary increase, we're proposing 1%. With the usual eligibility requirements. And then on line 59, because we still have this really odd 1.0 for above satisfactory, and the existing language is 1.7 for outstanding, and no one can seem to explain why that ratio exists. And so to make life easier for everybody understanding it, just making it 1.5, so it's 1.5 times the amount. I can't figure out what 1.7 would be, like the natural logarithm of 3, something like that. It's just a weird... Does anybody in HR know? I see heads shaking and a little bit of laughter. It's like just a mystery.
Always been to me. I can't guess 1.7 compared to everything else.
Yeah. It's odd.
And this, then going on to the next, we'll look into that, John. To the next thing is the there's
right on line 60. What we have in our proposal are two separate equity increases, and so this is getting after the problem of trying to solve some of the existing salary inequities that are out there. So one form of that the inequity occurs, or one mechanism that's generated, is that there are groups of employees that aren't eligible due to the nature of their position for TIP, RIA, and SOTL. And so we've got broad categories, entire units, where no one has gotten those awards, ever. And it's because it's not in their job description. And then even within units where some people would have access to the awards, other faculty members, because of the nature, again, of their assignments, don't qualify for TIPs. So it could be, for example, folks say in biology, if they're teaching a specialized course that's a lab course, they could have literally the most contact hours, the actual amount of classroom time and lecture plus lab combined, and not even counting prep time in there. But because they're small, intensive courses like comparative anatomy, where the students are doing a lot of dissections and things, they're small courses. And so they never get up to or they haven't ever managed to meet the TIP criteria over the past, you know, some people, 2 decades. And so what this language is intended to do is to reward folks who've been doing above satisfactory or outstanding work just repeatedly throughout their career with a $5,000 increase to their base salary. So that's starting to address the inequity. What it doesn't address, though, is the compounding effect, where if they'd had a tip award earlier, 5 or 10 years earlier, then any sort of salary increase that was proportional would have been added on to that. And so this is a step towards addressing the inequity. It doesn't counteract it entirely, but at least it's a good step forward. So that's the part that's in line 61 to 65. In part two there, this is just a repeat of what we did the last time, which we felt was very effective, dedicating 0.2% of the total base salary to the folks whose salaries are below those of beginning teachers in the Orange County public school system. So again, it's bringing the folks who are furthest away up the most, but it's not going to jumble up the order of salaries or anything like that. And so folks who are very close to those thresholds, they'll move a little bit up. Folks who are further away will move quite a bit more. And folks who were involved in bargaining last year know how that works. And then part D, 74 and 75, that's our normal parity language that we've put in. And I was looking at Sherry to see if she was going to smile or scowl at me today. And for the record, she's smiling. All right. So then, line 81 is just specifying what year we're talking about. Line 82 and 83, we had put that in last year to get things in the right time sequence, so now we don't need that, so we can strike that out. In line 92 to 93, the whole point to the equity increase is to redress the inequity that occurred when folks either weren't eligible because their unit as a whole doesn't perform the sort of functions that are rewarded with tip reinsodal. And then the other category is that there are folks who, by nature of their work, they're studio artists, they've got small classes because it's hands-on, they won't become eligible. Is to just strike that current productivity criterion out of there. Because then you wouldn't have that issue, and you also wouldn't have folks trying to, you know, asking their chairs to be put into courses where maybe they're not the best instructor to be in there just to qualify for tips. And that does happen, and that makes no sense. That would be like the ninth place hitter in your baseball lineup getting moved up to first to get more at bats. I mean, you just don't do stuff like that. And then on page three, with the incentive awards, we just put in the language about people being eligible every 5 years, establishing deadlines so that folks know ahead of time and we can avoid the confusion that we had this year with deadlines coming at unusual times and then having to be extended and things like that. So the particular one about deadlines, the ones we've suggested are ones that seem to make sense and spread them out, but we're certainly open to suggestions on that, but we'd like to see a deadline in there just so everybody knows and the colleges can get ready and folks know it's coming and can try to configure their workloads to be able to take advantage of it when it does come. And then the part F is trying to simplify the applications, so that they're consistent across colleges and so that the electronic platform will be the same, because I know from Mason shared with me his instructions that came from CAH, where they had a protocol that was different from really what the platform erected, and so he's literally got something from, was it your dean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Associate dean,
where it's marked up and telling faculty where to put things because there's no, it doesn't fit. And so I looked at that and I said, oh my goodness, it's worse than I thought. Because that you know, faculty are under enough time pressure and having, you know, two sets of documents and having to make sure that you've got everything where it belongs, that's just an added stress that we can alleviate pretty easily by just simplifying the application process. And I think it's also a wise move in terms of the cost-benefit ratio to the institution. So the cost is in having faculty taking time out to do these big applications when that probably really isn't necessary. And you could whittle it down to the essence much more easily. And so then the cost-benefit ratio is more favorable. Because I know when I did my TIP a few years back, it took up a week. You know, and that's a week I could have spent doing something else. And that's just not good from an institutional standpoint, from the faculty member's standpoint, even from that standpoint of the students who would rather have faculty doing something else probably during that time period. And everything else on pages 4 is just grammatical changes. 5 has literally, I think, no changes. And 6, just getting the dates up to where I hope they're supposed to be. I'm looking over to Charlie to see if I've goofed or if we've goofed. And then page 7 had no change.
Okay. All right. Thank you, John. Like I said, I think what we want to do is take this back and consider it and read it carefully, then we'll come back with questions.
Okay.
Sherry, there's a presenter today?
Yeah. We had sent you an email saying that Tracy Clark, who is the university comptroller, right?
No.
No.
Not anymore. Christy Dan's the controller now.
Okay, so official title.
So associate provost for budget planning and administration and associate vice president for finance and accounting.
Yeah, she's our budget guru.
Yeah, and I have been the controller until just about 6 months ago since I got here in 1987.
She just recently did a presentation to the Board of Trustees on the budget, mm-hmm. and I thought it would be helpful for us to see what she's telling the trustees and give us some little information about how our budget is structured and where the money comes from.
Mm-hmm. Do you have Article 3 or 23 for us today?
No. As a matter of fact, I think I told you we weren't coming with the 23.
Yeah. Does anybody have bargaining authority for either one of those articles right now?
Well, we would for 3. We won't for 23 until we see what the budget's going to be, what we're going to get from the state.
Well, but the overall budget for UCF has been going up, and the budget allocated to faculty has been relatively constant. So if you look at the coefficients of variation, it's very small. You should be able to plan that ahead of time.
Yeah, well, we don't. I mean, typically, since I've been doing bargaining, we have invited the provision of an economic item like wages, and then we take that back and consider it. We don't come and just exchange paper in the absence of understanding and considering your request.
Right. But you're saying that you're not going to be able to bargain salaries. So why are we bargaining in, you know, we set this date ahead of time. Why did we agree to that date if you're not prepared to bargain salaries? I mean, you just said no one's got authority to bargain salaries now. So that's the biggest of the two articles we've got. Half of the schedule.
Well, that isn't what we're saying, John. What we're saying is that we came today to see what you wanted to present to us, and we're going to take it back and consider it. I don't know what our response will be and when it will come. I mean, it might be sooner than later. But that's always been the process that I've experienced, not just here, but everywhere.
But what's the sense in having bargaining dates in March if you're not going to be ready to bargain salaries? And especially on the budget, there's relatively little variance from year to year in our bargaining unit's percentage of the overall budget.
Well, why don't you let Tracy show you?
She has to leave at 1:15, right?
Yeah, so let's...
Yes, I can talk...
Before you start, you know, I want to make clear that we can read budgets, and we also can get experts from our parent organizations, from UFF, NEA, FAT, or AFT, and FEA, to look at budgets. And at least in my time on the bargaining team, we've also hired outside folks who've been in academia and in similar positions to yours to scrutinize budgets. So we can read budgets. It's not an issue for us.
So you're not interested in the university's position on its budget?
Once you bring a proposal, then we'd be interested in discussing it. But generalities and how, you know, the mechanics, we're not interested in that.
How long is the presentation?
That's okay. I'm due to be somewhere at 1:20 at the Mortgage Reading Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I can talk, you know, we can just walk through the next 15 minutes what I've got or however far we
I think it'd be very informational and educational.
Just informational, and you can.
Let's see what she has to say.
Is this the same presentation that you gave to the Senate, the faculty Senate?
To the Senate,
Senate
partially, yes.
So at least some people here saw that,
right?
So.
Go ahead, Tracy.
Please.
Okay. All right, so I just wanted to present to you, let's see how this works. What do I click here to move forward?
This button right here.
This one? Okay. Okay, so the university budget is made up of three budgets, the operating budget, the capital budget, and then there's direct support organization budgets are all separate. And then, of course, we have the auditor's financial statement process, which happens every year. So this is just the development of the E&G budget process. This is a little bit what you were just talking about, and so I'll go through this very quickly, but basically in the first half of the fiscal year, which starts in July, the university and the Board of Governors works on submitting the university's what they call legislative budget requests or any budget requests to the legislative staff. In January, the governor comes out with what's called the governor's budget, which you were just talking a little bit about. That budget really ends up not necessarily having any authority. It just is sort of an indication to the House and the Senate about what the governor's thinking and maybe some ideas that he has. It usually the final budget usually doesn't mirror the governor's budget. It might mirror certain things like we're not going to raise tuition. If the governor lays that out, the legislature might follow his lead on something like that. So we have to be careful when the governor's budget comes out. It's just a little bit of a thought of what he's thinking about. Over what's happening right now and through the months of March and April, the legislature, the House and the Senate both work on creating their own budget bill. And then after the House comes out with a budget bill and the Senate comes out with a budget bill, a conference committee is put together from both of those legislative branches. And then they ultimately, in sometime in mid to late April, come out with a conference bill, a legislative budget bill for the governor to sign. So where we're at right now is we haven't even seen the House and the Senate yet. We're just hearing grumblings from them at this point of, you know, what they're thinking. So that's the process. That's in April is kind of when we first find out what that looks like they might do with our education general state appropriations budget. Feel free to ask me any questions if you have them. And then in parallel to that, during February and May is when the University Budget Committee reviews funding requests and makes budget allocation decisions and recommendations to the provost and the president. So they're kind of in the same boat as what was just talked about here in that, you know, there's discussions of funding needs, but we really don't know what the final budget from the state is going to be until we get closer to April. and May. In May, the Board of Trustees, by then we should have the budget from the legislature, and it will just be, we will present it to the Board of Trustees for their approval, just subject to the governor's signing it. The governor has veto authority, so it could change, and if it does, then our university-approved budget will change accordingly. And then back to July, the fiscal year begins. So that's the process. The operating budget at the university level consists of several budget entities, and that's what you're seeing here. So education in general consists of state appropriations and tuition, student tuition, and out-of-state fees. So when we talk about the education in general budget, or the E&G budget, it's made up of those two components, state appropriations and E&G, or tuition and fees. The other categories include auxiliary budgets, sponsored research budgets, financial aid, student activities, that's a fee paid for by the students per credit hour. The technology fee is a fee paid for by students. Concessions is a small amount that's received from some vending machines across campus. And then each DSO, which stands for direct support organizations, those are separate legal entities, and their boards approve a budget, and then that comes to the overall Board of Trustees for approval. This is the university's budget for the year that we're operating in right now. You can see the education general budget. This is made up of, again, state appropriations and student tuition. The College of Medicine has a separate E&G budget, and that's dictated by the legislature. And then these other numbers account for those other, we call them budget entities, which is auxiliaries, research, student financial aid, etc. So this is the budget that is approved by the Board of Trustees. This is how the education general budget is currently allocated across the university. So the budget that we just saw on the last page is accumulation of budget that's been received over the years and has already been allocated out to all of the units.
Could you refer to the previous slide for a second?
Let's see, how do I go back?
Go to right there, and then go to previous. Go up to the top. Use the mouse. There you go. Click on previous with the left button.
Is that previous? There we go.
Yeah. Shouldn't the bottom one be a B, pavilion?
Well, because, yes. I guess I think that's a comma 726. So 1,726. So it's 1.7 billion.
Gotcha.
Okay. Okay. This is how the education general budget is currently distributed, or was in 16-17, across all of the divisions and the different units that support the university. So you can see the academic affairs, which includes all of the colleges, as well as some other areas like international and faculty excellence, the provost's office, that kind of thing. And then you can see all the different sort of divisions across the university and how the education general budget is already allocated. This is just an example of that. On that previous page, you saw $252 million for an auxiliary budget. This is just some of your major auxiliaries. This refers back to the university's audited financial statements. So just to a little bit to contrast the budget with the actual financial statements. And this is the balance sheet, or the financial statement of financial position at the end of this past year. So you can see that our assets, and what's something that's called deferred outflows, which is similar to an asset, minus the university's liabilities, come to what they call the net position on our financial statements. The net position is separated on the financial statements between investment and capital assets. That's all of our facilities, restricted net position, and unrestricted net position.
What comprises some of the restricted net position?
Restricted would include things like financial aid, contracts and grants, anything that, those are the two main categories. Anything that has to do with contract and grant activity is anything that's restricted by some sort of a document or an external document that requires a certain way that those funds are used. Okay. Is what's considered restricted. Unrestricted is includes everything else. So this is a chart. I'm sorry, it's kind of hard to read, but this is just diagram that's grouped at some level of the unrestricted net position at the end of this past fiscal year. So you can see that that $203 million is about $126 million, if you add up the auxiliary ones, is housed in the different auxiliaries. These are basically the resources of each individual auxiliary. All of our auxiliaries have to be self-supporting, and they're not allowed to be supported by education and general funding. So the fund balance is separated between E&G, student activities, the technology fee, some financial aid that's not restricted by external documents, and then you can see the education and general categories. And you see, I think that one large orange slice is the education and general net position for all of the colleges across campus. So this just disseminates that number down to the different areas where it belongs and where it's housed. On the capital budgets, let's see, I got 5 minutes. So capital budgets are just separate. So when we have when we receive funding from the state for capital projects, that funding is kept separate from the $1.7 billion operating budget that you saw. So capital budget funding for capital projects comes from what's known as PICO funding. The students pay a per credit hour fee called the Capital Improvement Trust Fund fee. So that's a source of funding for capital projects. Bond proceeds. So a lot of the auxiliaries that you saw in the previous fund balance slide have issue bonds, and then they have sort of debt service proceeds, bond covenants, and all kinds of things that they have to do to be able to issue bonds for all of our for some of our major auxiliary activities. So when a new parking garage goes up, a lot of times that's being funded by a bond, or partially funded by a bond. If there's some resources within the parking system that they can make a down payment on a parking garage, they try to do that. That helps us get better bond terms for the bonds and terms for the interest rates. And so all of the bond proceeds help us with auxiliaries. You can't get bond proceeds for any type of facility that isn't revenue generating. So an academic building that doesn't have the ability to pay back the debt service can't receive bonds. So that's why you see that happening mostly in our auxiliary activities. Okay, so donations come from the foundation as we try to raise, enter into fundraising activities. So a lot of donation and philanthropy was used down at the College of Medicine when those facilities were built. So a lot of activities you might see that get capital activities get funded by restricted donations to the foundation. And then anything that we use internally earned funding for is another way that we help try to keep our facilities up and running.
How large is our endowment?
Approximately $150 million.
Okay, up in the paper, okay.
So just real quickly, the direct support organizations, you're probably aware of that. We have, I think, about 7 or 8 direct support organizations. So the UCF Foundation is a direct support organization. The UCF Stadium Corporation is a direct support organization. The UCF Athletics Association, these are all separate legal entities. They all have their own operating budget, their own revenue streams. Sometimes activities that are going on around campus are activities that are owned and funded and managed by the direct support organizations. So here's a list of the direct support organizations that were included in that $1.7 billion budget last year.
Tracy, can well, go ahead, and I want to ask you question that before you get out of here.
Okay, you can. This just shows the amounts and the numbers that are in that overall budget that really are in these separate legal entities.
Mm-hmm. We often hear that we have so much money in unrestricted funds, which and the claim is made that if they're unrestricted, they can be used for any purpose. Can you address that?
Yeah, so the pie chart showed the unrestricted fund balance. So there's a couple things to note about fund balance. One, it is at a point in time, so it's a one-time snapshot of fund balance, which is made up of your assets minus your liabilities. It's not a recurring source of money. It's just a one point in time balance. And that pie chart showed all of the areas at a somewhat grouped level as to who owns, so to speak, that fund balance, or who has generated that fund balance. So, for example, parking has a fund balance that it is required to retain to continue the parking operations, to meet its debt service requirements, to meet its bond covenants, and to continue to fund the parking system, which includes
the... that's still in that unrestricted
category. Right, because
there's
no...
Even though it's required to maintain that amount.
Right.
We couldn't steal it from there and give it to somebody else.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But it's also not encumbered, right?
What do you mean by encumbered?
Meaning that there's an encumbrance placed on that money, meaning that that money's not to be spent for anything else.
No, it's not to be spent outside of the parking system. There's actually Board of Governor regulations that restrict or expect that an auxiliary activity that's charging certain student fees or decal fees or any other revenue sources uses that funding for the parking system. So they don't allow us to charge a parking fee or a decal fee and then use that money to go do something else with it.
But parking's unusual in that regard because it has bonds let out.
Yeah.
Right?
So
what about the other units, the E and G and the others? Are those funds encumbered?
So encumbered, in my world anyway, means there's purchase orders mm-hmm. against something.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean that they are not... an encumbrance is a outstanding purchase order. So those funds are basically the operating funds for each of the units that hold those funds. So they will have... obligations the very next month that those funds will go towards. They will have reserve requirements that they're expected to hold. They will have future capital repairs and maintenance and plans that those funds are to be used for. So if you're talking about a purchase order, there's not a purchase order against that, but those funds are restricted to or are expected to stay in that auxiliary and fund that continual operation. So you wouldn't want your parking system to end the year with zero fund balance, or it would be basically insolvent.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You keep using the word expected and restricted. You keep vacillating between the two, and you seem to be landing on expect versus restrict. And you mentioned that the policy, you initially said restrict, then you switched to expect. Seems like a pretty big difference between the two words. Obviously, it's unrestricted funds, so it can't be restricted, so there's
right.
an expectation.
That's why I'm
around.
Vacillating away from restricted. Restricted on the financial statements has a certain connotation of an external document, like a contract or grant agency restriction or financial aid, restriction. Within the financial statements, unrestricted includes things like general operations of the health center. So the health center operates, it has revenue sources, it has financial obligations against it, and it is a continuing business operation. So the funds that are in the health center stay in the health center to continue to support the health center operations. Education and general funding is not allowed to be used to support any of the auxiliary activities. And so they have to be self-supporting. There is a requirement that all of our auxiliaries stay self-supporting as an institution. And then there also are, like I said, those restrictions used loosely to say we can't charge parking fees that are higher than is necessary to run our parking system prudently. And then take those funds, basically charge a student parking fees or charge anyone a parking revenue source, and then turn around and use those funds for something else. The parking fees are supposed to support the parking system.
In terms of some of the other things that aren't parking, when Sherry used the word steal from other places, you really mean reprioritize from other places, right?
No, she said that you can't reprioritize.
But there are some parts of this that can be reprioritized. It's not all locked away. Go back to
your pie chart.
It's just an expectation, right? That's what I'm getting.
But she also said that there were board
governors'
regulations.
But the policy said expects.
it, again, coming back to that really sort of stuck with me, this exception, expectation versus restriction.
What?
It just seems a bit looser, which is actually what you said as well.
It's, you know, yeah, well, and I know you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
But so, and I know we've kept you later than, but I think I actually heard what you said and understood it, and I can explain it. So.
Well, you can just read the policy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
John, I'm in response to your comment about why are we even here if we're not prepared to bargain. There are a lot of things in your proposal that we can certainly begin the process of bargaining that do not involve whatever raise money we're going to put on the table. I mean, you've got a lot of things in here regarding the awards, regarding promotion, whether that's the appropriate way to allocate money. There's a lot of bargaining that can be done here without us coming and saying, well, this is, we're going to give you a 2% across the board or a 2% merit or whatever this year.
Okay,
so,
well, that's good to hear. That's encouraging.
Yeah, and beyond that, you know, when we've had this conversation before, there's, in every wage article, there's two aspects to be bargained, which is the process of where the money goes, and then the amount. How there's the amount, how it's spent. So we certainly sometimes how much we have requires some time to come into focus, but we can certainly talk about how we would spend whatever money we have. And what
so
our
priorities. Should we be prepared to do that next time, or should we not meet next time?
We have some time to arrange. You know, we need to cancel. We can let you know.
Yeah, let us, John. Let us go. Let us, like I said, read this carefully and talk. You know, have an opportunity to process it.
Okay. Well, if nothing else, we should be able. We hopefully we'll be able to come back with some clarity on. There's some additional ideas on Article 3 about the timing, especially Charlie.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't know if we have anything more for today, though. Do we, Chair? Do you have anything else, John?
No. Gave you everything we had.
Okay, great.
All we had prepared.
3 and 23, that's our focus. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, all of you.
And our next date is the 3rd? That's correct. Okay. Third, not 30th.
Sorry, third.
Third,
yeah.
Three.
I think we can turn this on.
We turn at 1:22.